now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Oliver Kay, Alison Rudd, and, because you had trouble getting out of bed this morning, Mr. Paddy Barkley. Today we'll discuss Manchester United's visit to White Hart Lane and Arsenal's win over West Ham. We'll also be taking a look at the credibility and practicalities of financial fair play. So please join us for the next 35 minutes or so. Okay, one TV company described it as, I think it was like Derby Hat Trick Day or something, but we won't be talking about the Birmingham Derby or the Liverpool Derby or indeed the Northeast Derby in our Premier League review, because we're going to talk about Spurs and Manchester United first. And one thing that jumps out at me straight off the bat was that I thought Spurs kind of had the better of this game and maybe didn't create the better chances, but certainly I thought held the pitch better, took it to United, and I thought United seemed kind of happy with the point. Paddy?
Yeah, that's absolutely my reading. I think Spurs showed that they can play football against anybody. Okay, Manchester United might not be the best ever Manchester United side, but the best England has to offer this season. And yeah, I think as you say, they held the field. They looked comfortable. They played the sort of football they would play against anybody else, and that was very important given the history of Manchester United Tottenham games. But at the end of the day, it's 2 points dropped for Spurs, and one further step towards Manchester United champions.
It was a surreal game, I thought, because I thought it was a cracking game.
It was.
A really cracking game. And yet, the stats kept coming up, you know, only three shots on target. And you thought, oh, but it doesn't feel like a game with only three shots on target. And, well, no, three shots and one on target halfway through the first half. It was a peculiar game because it felt quite one-sided. It felt like only one team would score. And yet the stats made out that probably Manchester United were the stronger team on the day.
Ollie, do you buy this this analysis from Rudd?
Yeah, I thought the first 20 minutes was terrific. I mean, it was end to end, and I mean, more towards the United goal, in fairness, but it was end to end. Both teams were looking like they meant business, and I thought it just maybe it was a case of United drawing the sting out of the game slightly. I thought Spurs lost a little bit of momentum towards half time, and the second half. I think it ran out of steam a little bit, and then Spurs had the sort of late flurry, as indeed United did after Raphael summing off. But looking at the league table, you would not think that United were 8 points ahead of Spurs, having played a game fewer. I mean, there doesn't look like that kind of gap between the teams. I know Redknapp feels that Spurs are in the title race. I think it shows at the moment. I mean, I think yesterday shows that they look like equals man for man, but United just seem to pick up points when they don't play well, and seem to Spurs don't quite have that clear instinct. I don't think, and they didn't yesterday at least.
I thought Spurs were very good defensively. The central defensive partnership for the first time, I think, in a while against a big opponent, looked really solid. But speaking of defenders, I mean, Ollie touched upon it there. Raphael sending off, I thought, was this shades of the Bayern Munich game last year where he did get a silly sending off, which incensed Sir Alex, but is the kind of thing that you know, you would expect with a little bit more nous and maybe a little bit more experience, you don't pick up a second yellow that way? Or was it maybe the right call, or was he treated harshly? Paddy?
Well, I think the lad's got a problem. I mean, his temperament's terrible. His eyes glaze over, you know, and that's not a good sign. Normally, players lose their temper, and you can almost see the brain cogs whirring as they compose themselves and regain their concentration. He's a bit of a serial offender, as you pointed out, the Munich instance where he was a stupid sending off and some fairly foolish comments from Ferguson afterwards, which verged on the xenophobic. I think that Raphael has developed into a superb modern fullback this season. The only slight problem would be that opponents will be aware that United have two small fullbacks, which you can't always get away with in the modern game. But he looks like a terrific prospect. But the temperament is a real problem. You know, he's been, I don't know how many games he's played, but it must be 50 now, and it should be getting better. But, you know, he's young and he may learn.
Do you think Ferguson should have taken him off at half time?
God, definitely, yes. I think that I don't know who was on the bench. I'm trying to remember who was on the bench, but I think it was pretty obvious that he was on borrowed time from the first yellow card, which could, I mean, it was a bit orange. I thought it was a horrible challenge.
Yeah, exactly. The nature of the challenge and the fact that he was up against Bale, who, you know, he's tricky throughout a game.
Yeah.
It seemed like a no-brainer that you would take him off. But,
I agree.
On that point, United had Smalling and Johnny Evans on the bench. So I guess there was no natural right-back replacement unless you wanted to start messing around with putting Fletcher at right-back. Ollie?
In Raphael's defence, I mean, the second yellow card did look rather trivial. Also in his defence, I think if you look at his disciplinary record, the yellow cards have sort of dried up a little bit this season. It's just that when he committed that sort of fairly wild challenge, it wasn't a two-footed challenge, but it was a wild challenge that was certainly worthy of a card in the first half. You just looked at him and you thought, well, he is an accident waiting to happen because he's got Gareth Bale taking him on. You know, Tottenham have people that will run at him. And although United have this great sense of injustice over the red card, and you heard Ferguson's remarks and you saw Raphael's reaction, which I thought was bordering on the disrepute charge, the way he confronted the referee. If you look at it, yes, he pulled his hands away, and so it looked like he didn't bring him down, but he did run across the guy. I think he knew what he was doing, but I don't think he thought he would get a second booking for it. I think as well as being rash, he had a slightly cynical side. And I think that although he might not always expect to get a yellow card for it, he knew what he was doing.
So there you go. It's a thoroughly nasty piece of work. We've just ruined his career.
Moving on to a match that Alison attended on Saturday night. West Ham and Arsenal. Now, there was quite a dramatic build-up to this game regarding the West Ham manager, Avram Grant. But I want to start with Arsenal because I kind of feel that if Vermaelen were fit and playing at Vermaelen levels, Arsenal would probably be my favorites to win the Premier League title this year. Based on what you saw, Alison, and on what you know, would I be wrong?
No, you'd be right, I think.
Yes.
It's just the first time we've ever agreed, Kev. Because Arsenal were playing third, fourth gear, certainly not fifth gear, and tearing into what obviously is a very weak West Ham side. Arsenal were the Arsenal everyone loves. They were playing beautifully weighted passes. They all looked completely singing off the same song sheet in harmony. Walcott looked like the player we always hoped he would be. Van Persie looked like that big, strong centre forward that no one can deal with. They had everything except at the back they looked a little tentative and a little overindulgent and gave West Ham the odd moment of hope when they should have had absolutely none. Vermaelen is a quite superb player who made an instant impact when he came here, which is rare indeed, and a very impressive centre-back, and if he was there, they would be leading the table now, undoubtedly.
Ollie, I think it can take time. It can take some time for a centre half to settle in the Premier League, especially one maybe who comes from France and a small team in France at that, like Laurent Koscielny. But I get the sense that he's playing better now than he was at the start of the year. But I go back to this, given the difficulties that Scalacci has had. Is it Koscielny-Giroud partnership? Is that Premier League winning material to you?
Well, when Alisson was talking about Vermaelen just now, I mean, I agree he's an excellent player. But I thought in the summer with Gas and others leaving, I thought they needed to sort of... The partner for Vermaelen, I thought, needed to be somebody more dominant, more assertive, more physical than Vermaelen. I don't think he's particularly that kind of player. He's a fantastically elegant and intelligent defender, but I thought they needed somebody more dominant, and they've got the guys they've brought in, Koscielny and Scalacci, and they've got Giroud, sort of, they're trying to regenerate him and get him looking like the player he was meant to be when he was 18. And they just lack really dominant central defenders. They lack a dominant goalkeeper. You could say they lack really dominant central midfield players, yet the talent there in their team suggests that they will be challenging. So, I mean, you do wonder just how good a team they would be with those players that they lack. But I think they're challenging, and will continue to challenge. But it's just that you think that those weaknesses in central defence and in goal will resurface over the course of the season.
Paddy, I want to ask you on the back of what Ollie said. I mean, you said you sort of lamented the lack of a dominant central midfield player. Is Alex Song this season really that much worse or that much less dominant than Darren Fletcher, given the season Fletcher's been having?
No, I think Song has developed into a very, very good player. The only reservation I would have about him is that as he has developed and as fresh layers of talent have been unveiled, he's become less inclined to play as a holding midfield player. Which, of course, is where he should play. And they've had to bring in the Danielson, to do a lot of the sort of donkey work. But I think that... I don't think there's a problem with the Arsenal midfield anymore. I really don't. And I think that the problems are all entirely goalkeeper and two centre-backs. You know, I was thinking about this, that, it's very rare, if you go back over the history, the modern history of British football, to find a team that hasn't had excellent players in those positions. If you look at how Ferguson built it, Manchester United, it wasn't until he formed the unit of Bruce Pallister and Schmeichel that Manchester United developed a look of invincibility. I mean, it's you look at George Graham, how he built at Arsenal, and what he bequeathed to Arsene Wenger. You know, you need to have those positions filled by outstanding players. Okay, you might say Barcelona haven't always done that, but they're a special case. Certainly in British football, it's very unusual to win titles without outstanding players in those positions.
Your thoughts on Arsenal's title challenge?
The thing about Arsenal is that they won't draw games like United do. I mean, if you look at the league table, I'm just looking now, they've drawn 4 out of 22. It's either, I mean, generally they win a lot of matches. What is it? 13. They've won 13 matches, which is more than United. I think they will continue to win more matches than United. It's just that they're likely to lose an awful lot more. I see Arsenal challenging. I really do. I don't think they're particularly special. I don't think they've particularly rectified the weaknesses of previous seasons. But the bar is lower than it has been in the title race for a few years now. I do see Arsenal challenging. Do I see them winning it? They wouldn't be my favourites, but yes, certainly challenging.
I'd fancied them at the start of the season just for the title, just ahead of Chelsea, funnily enough. Probably got both of those wrong. But I do feel that there's a resilience about Arsenal. I find it extraordinary when people question their mental strength. I think they're a very tough bunch in that they believe in their way of playing, and they rather like Barcelona. You know, they're fighting for more than a manager. They're fighting for a way of life. You know, it's a good thing to have. You know, some people hate the word philosophy in football, but it is a very important thing to have. Look at Stoke. Look at the success of Stoke, the relative success. It doesn't matter what your philosophy is, as long as you have one. So I think that to that extent they will be resilient. And I would like them to win the league. I certainly would like them to win a trophy, because I'm so bored with people counting the minutes since Arsenal won a trophy.
A team that hasn't won a trophy in a while, although might yet do this year, are West Ham. Now, I need some guidance here. Now, it was obvious to that Avram Grant's position was in jeopardy. So Saturday afternoon, I flick on the West Ham Arsenal game after going to Stamford Bridge, and everybody's talking like, oh, so it's a case of when, not if, Avram Grant leaves and is replaced by Martin O'Neill, and Martin O'Neill this and that, and Grant's gone. Now, I appreciate, I mean, contrary to popular belief, we in the media don't generally just invent things. And I also appreciate that West Ham is probably the leakiest club in the history of English football. And I also understand that one of the West Ham Trinity is on television a lot, and former columnist for The Sun or whatever else. But I just wonder, how could people report as fact, even as late as Saturday night on Match of the Day, that Avram Grant had been sacked, when, as of right now, 11 a.m. Monday morning, the dude's still in a job? Was there some colossal mix-up here where they thought that they were going to give the job to O'Neill and then he maybe taking more time to think about it? Allison, you were there. You've got the inside track. Tell us.
Well, I think what happened is that the board is divided at West Ham. So what do you do if you want your own way?
How is there a divided board when there's two owners? So
the triumvirate, as you call it, do not agree on how you get rid of Grant.
Yeah, but Karen Brady doesn't. Does she actually have a say in a decision like this, or would it not just be the people who actually pay the bills?
She has an opinion.
Right,
she's holding quite a lot of sway at the club at the moment.
Okay,
I have to be careful how I phrase this. So you have a board that are divided. And if you want your own way, if you're at the top of an organisation and you want your own way, you feed a line to the media, you let information out, and you portray that information as a fact, not just one member of the board's opinion. And a certain news organisation thinks, well, if a member of the board's saying that, someone very important at the club's saying that, it must be true. So we will go with it. But it doesn't mean that the club, as an organisation, has actually decided to do what that one individual is saying is going to happen and wants to happen. You need to get the manager in. You need to agree terms of severance, what he's allowed to say, what he's not allowed to say. You need a board that agrees you don't get rid of a manager until you've got one who's practically signed on the dotted line what his job will be. So it was bizarre that the BBC went with it, because none of those things were in place. It was simply someone trying to engineer a move that they wanted to happen, when there are other members of the West Ham board who are trying very hard not to seem like sacking board members.
Ollie, why do they care so much whether they're seen as trigger-happy managers, given that they've hired a guy whose team is in last place, right? I mean, they're the owners, they're the money, they got to keep West Ham up. I mean, if you were to sack Avram Grant, nobody would say, like, oh, look, you know, how horrible and how unfair, as long as you did it in the right way, right? Or am I wrong on this?
No, I think you're entirely right. And I think the handling of it is the ham-fisted handling of it is creating sympathy for Grant and ill feeling against the owners in a way that would never have happened had it been done smoothly and clinically rather than cynically. And if you look at the attempt to get O'Neill, for me, and from everything I understand of the man and of the workings of that club, I mean, obviously things could change here, but one thing that is certain to put yet more doubts in O'Neill's mind is this kind of leaking and this kind of sort of attempts to smoke him out and to smoke Avram Grant out. It's just an enormous misunderstanding of the situation, and it ends with them towards the end of the week feeling that Avram Grant's position is completely untenable, yet not knowing where to turn in terms of the new manager. Well, they will only have themselves to blame because they have handled it really, really badly.
Yeah, Paddy, if Margaret Mountford were the chief executive of West Ham, I'm assuming this wouldn't be happening, right?
Sorry, who? Margaret Mountford?
Yes.
I mean, to me, she's a perfect example of the best kind of chief executive. The best kind of chief executive is the one you never see. I think that...
As opposed to Karen Brady, who we see all the time everywhere?
Oh, well, you used the words Karen Brady. I wasn't going to bring that in. No, I think...
It's not like the words Karen...
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Brady are an obscenity. I think we are allowed to say it, right?
Yes,
I think obscenity might apply more to some of their to the people who employ her, but yes. That's another issue.
I agree. I think that I mean it's almost axiomatic that poor Ron Greenwood would be turning in his grave. I mean, this is not West Ham at all, and it's very odd that these two, you know, boyhood lovers of West Ham, Gold and Sullivan, should be, you know, the people who were pledged to restore the club to its former glory, should be dragging it to ever greater opprobrium. It occurs to me that West Ham are going down and probably aren't too bothered about that. I mean, certainly the way they're behaving in January suggests almost a death wish or a relegation wish. I don't know quite what they're playing at.
They tried to do it last year, didn't they, when they brought in Mito and Benny McCarthy. But
it will end in the NPower Championship. And, you know, as to whether the owners are happy with that... we can't look into their minds, but I tell you what, I shouldn't be too surprised if they were fairly sanguine about the possibility of going down.
Just to wrap this up, I wanted to touch upon Martin O'Neill. Now, regular listeners of mine will know that I do not share in the unquestioned hero worship of Martin O'Neill, but I do think he's a person of integrity, as evidenced by the fact that, yeah, unlike the rest of the dung heap of gutless conformity, which is most managers, he didn't go and cry to get a big payoff when he left Villa. He just kind of resigned and said, thank you very much. You've been paying me until now, and I'm no longer employed to you. I'm going now. Yeah. I just wonder, I mean, Ollie touched upon it before, right? surely he's an intelligent guy. He's a person who even his enemies would say has values and principles. He wouldn't want to go and work for these people in these conditions. So how is his name being linked to the Aston Villa job? To the West Ham job? Do we actually know that he's actually spoken to these individuals? Do we know any of this stuff for a fact, or are they just kind of plucking him out of thin air?
Well, his people have spoken to their people.
Definitely.
I think so. I'm pretty sure about that. But the weirdest part is Martin O'Neill is a big friend of the BBC. He loves the BBC and they love him. So why on earth didn't they ask him? All they did was talk to people who'd met him once on a golf course 4 weeks ago, saying, yeah, he looked a little depressed. Maybe he needs to get back to work. And from that, they construed that he was definitely going back into business and into West Ham. It's very odd reporting. But yeah, the thing is, it's lovely the way these things evolve. He was, 99% of people thought that was a dead cert, that Saturday at 3 o'clock, Martin O'Neill was going to be short-term manager of West Ham by midnight. And now most people are thinking, why would someone of Martin O'Neill's calibre and reputation do that?
All right, well, just to terminate this, I need a very quick answer from everybody. Percentage chance that Martin O'Neill is the West Ham manager in the next 2 weeks. Patty?
60.
Ollie?
20.
Rudd?
33.
Ooh, heard it here first. Now, last week, UEFA gave more details about their financial fair play plan, which is actually available on the internet. It's like a 130-odd page document downloadable in PDF form for anybody who wants to know more. But in a nutshell, what it means is over three seasons, starting with the 2011 financial years, UEFA will be looking at clubs' profit and losses from football-related activities. Some expenses will be exempted from it, like stadium building and youth development. But in a nutshell, if you have cumulative losses over those 3 years of more than 45 million euros, then you will not be given a license to play in the Champions League or the Europa League. And that'll be effective from the 2014-2015 season. The year after that, the amount of allowable losses will go down to 30 million. And then after that, it will go down even further. We don't quite know how much. Opinions on financial fair play, on its impact and its effectiveness are very much divided. But one person's opinion I haven't heard yet is Ollie Kays. Ollie, good or bad?
I think it's a great principle that would stop clubs, dicing with death and, risking their whole future on players on big wages, etc. But I have to say my persistent view with this is that, and the real problem is that it will sustain an existing, it's very much a sort of measure that would mean that the rich stay rich and the poor stay poor. It seems to sort of reinforce whatever class divides there are within football. And if you look at the big movers behind it, it's clubs like Manchester United and Bayern Munich who are those who are going to be better served by it than anybody else. If you look at a club like Manchester City, you'll be thinking, well, is this designed to scupper our ambitions? And to an extent, I think it is. There's an awful lot of things that Manchester City could say about why they are run better than certain clubs in terms of where the investment goes and so on. I think some of the wages and transfer fees they pay are absurd, but they haven't got huge interest payments going out every year like Manchester United have, like Bayern Munich have, like Real Madrid have, and yet they are going to be the ones who are sort of frozen out by this because they don't have years and years of huge revenue streams and commercial markets and so on. I can see the positives of it, but there are an awful lot of flaws in it, as far as I can see.
Paddy, you were in Neon hanging out with the financial fair play folks from UEFA last week. Your take.
Well, the more time goes by, the more one realizes that that European football is going to be governed by or underpinned by bureaucracy, accountants and analysts are going to become almost as important as agents. It is to a large degree unworkable simply because of the scale of scrutiny required. But the there is no alternative. The status quo is not an option. Football was getting deeper and deeper into debt and more distorted. And that clubs, well, if you look at the English example, clubs who build gradually, who have enlightened ownerships and enlightened financial policies, such as Aston Villa and Everton, find their progress blocked by the constant reemergence of one sugar daddy after another who prices them out of the market for players. If you talk to David Moyes and or indeed Martin O'Neill about his Aston Villa experience, they both hit the ceiling, and their talent is unfairly disadvantaged. I mean, there's a desperate need for financial fair play. Whether the game can actually afford, has the will to afford proper policing is another matter. What I gleaned from the visit to Nyon was that financial fair play will be almost voluntary. You basically will make your books. You will have them. You will offer them to UEFA, and UEFA will make somebody described it last night as speed bumps. It's a way of catching some. It will be abused, but it's still a hell of a lot better than doing nothing. And I think also, furthermore, if you look at the leagues which believe in prudence and good governance, I'm thinking in particular of the German, you don't get the rich becoming richer and success becoming set in stone. If you look at Germany, it's probably the most meritocratic league, the league where teams like Hoffenheim, Mainz, and so on can emerge and finish above Bayern Munich, who, of course, on the face of it, have the highest turnover. So I do think that experience shows that financial fair play, for all the possibilities, for all the mud you can throw at it, is still a hell of a lot better than the free market.
Alison, getting back to the specific, I mean, you're a noted leftist. So, what I want to ask you is this: by implementing these rules, we're basically capping costs because clubs can't overspend and so on, and transfer fees are going to come down, wages are going to come down. But ultimately, doesn't that benefit the owners above everybody else? And I refer you to what Arsene Wenger said on Friday, which he said, people have a problem with footballers making so much money, but football generates so much money. If the players were paid less, it would just be more profit for the owners. Now, you may find it obscene that Wayne Bridge makes £90,000 a week, but is that more obscene than, say, Sheikh Mansour being born with £500 billion and then going and spending them, and he'll just make even more money now?
Such big issues, Gerb. I agree with Ollie. I find the Platini's vision, I find it very odd. It seems to be that he's going to take an arbitrary point in history and he's deciding the clubs that are big at this point in history will stay big and there'll be no change ever again, because the only way you can truly revolutionise a club's fortune is to allow it to have some influx of money so it can attract sponsors,
Alison.
And it can attract players and it can build stadiums, and
Alison.
That means the people who exist
Alison.
Who are big will always be big.
Alison, can I just insert a few facts here? Debt for stadium building and youth development and many other things is perfectly legitimate under financial fair play. There is nothing in financial fair play that will stop Manchester City. Absolutely nothing. This is a myth.
Actually, sorry, Paddy, if I can interject on that, not only is debt on stadium building and youth development not counted against against the FFP profit and loss. But unlike transfers and wages, it doesn't require an equity investment. So let me give you this scenario, going back to what you were going back before. If Bournemouth, or better yet, actually, if Crawley decide that they want to build a 40,000-seat stadium and persuade some idiot bank to go and lend them £200 million, and then they just default on all the payments and, you know, get their friends who are gangsters to go and build the stadium or whatever, thereby defrauding the public purse, this wouldn't be covered by financial fair play. You could still go and do that. So how is this actually protecting fans, and how is this maintaining that social mobility that Alison was talking about?
Social mobility, I mean, the ability of a club to invest and grow is unaffected. The pace is affected. It would probably have taken Jack Walker longer to buy the title for Blackburn Rovers under financial fair play than it did. It arguably, you know, might have been sustained for longer. I don't know. But Manchester City, the owners of Manchester City, insist that they're there for the long term. If they are, then success will come, but when it does, it will be in a sustainable way. The club will grow in terms of youth development, in terms of infrastructure, and success will grow with it. I mean, this is the intention, and I would have thought that would be what we would want to see, rather than, in a way, much as we found the Blackburn model romantic. I mean, do we really want it to be as much of a lottery as it was there?
Ollie, since we forced you to be silenced for so long, you get the last word.
Well, I think that is the thing. It has gone, the emphasis has changed completely from anti-debt to anti-losses. The agenda has been gone from one being set by Platini to one being set by the leading European clubs, of which, you know, Manchester United, I mentioned, and it doesn't quite apply to Liverpool anymore, but after their latest takeover. So but they are, you know, a club who have been sort of spared, or who thought at the time they were going to be spared by this. But, you know, it's gone from being anti-debt and anti-everything that Manchester United supporters are so worried about, and pick notes, and, you know, the huge debt repayments that are needed, etc., those kind of clouds over a club's future, to being anti the kind of spending that Manchester City and Chelsea previously have indulged in. It's not great that Manchester City and Chelsea spend so much, but would Chelsea have had any prospect of getting league titles without that spending? No, they might have gone to the wall. But I don't know quite what the answer is, but to me, the problem with it, and the reason why it feels like it's being rushed through, even though we're talking about 3 years' time or whatever, is that they've gone from campaigning against one thing to campaigning against something else. And that, to me, seems to have come from influence from clubs like Manchester United, Bayern Munich, etc.
I second everything that Ollie Kay says, which makes it yet another victory for the Kay Marcotti team.
Axis.
Time now for some quick hits. Carlo Ancelotti says Chelsea have turned the corner after beating Blackburn 2-0. Alex is back in a few weeks, which should help, and the Abramovich fairy may yet deliver some reinforcements, possibly even Steven Pienaar. Paddy, is the future starting to look brighter?
Yes, I think it is. I think that the notion that Chelsea would even finish outside the top four now seems a little more fanciful. There was a feeling of business as usual after the Blackburn game, and I completely agree that Alex has become a very, very important player. And when he's back, Chelsea will look much more solid.
Yes, Alex, usually more important when he's not there than when he is. Alan Hansen expressed doubts over his mobility and pace, but it seemed to me that Edin Dzeko did his part in Manchester City's 4-3 win over Wolves, which of course keeps City in the title hunt. Ollie, are you as down on Dzeko as Mr. Hansen is? And should Mancini be happy that he won, or sad that he conceded three goals, or just sigh and say, this is normal?
I don't think many Italian managers are going to be terribly happy with winning 4-3. I think three goals conceded in a match like that, where they were in control, is clearly a problem for him. But as for Dzeko, mobility and pace isn't what he's about. He's a guy who's got great touch, great composure, great physical threat, good in the air. And I think after a month out of action, I think that was a very encouraging debut.
And I actually think he's got plenty of mobility and pace for a guy his size. And kind of disappointed that he was being judged on the 10 seconds of highlights that he watched. Liverpool and Everton share the spoils in the Merseyside derby. Alisson, what's different under Dalglish? And are these baby steps going to be enough for him to keep his job?
Dalglish is upbeat. Hodgson was downbeat. As long as fans go, as long as there are bums on seats in the Kop, as long as they keep singing happily, cheering Dalglish, as long as he keeps them up, then he will have the chance to be there next season. Otherwise, no.
So all you got to do is be happy and jolly and that's it?
Well, I think this is quick hits and this is a huge question. But I think the tipping point was that fans were not turning up at Anfield, and they are now.
Gab, question for you. Leo Messi wins the Ballon d'Or, but you're not happy. Why?
Well, I have no problem with Messi winning the Ballon d'Or, although it is a bit of a departure from, I think, some of the criteria that were applied in the past, which was to reward the best performer over the course of a season rather than necessarily the best player in the world. The reason I have a problem with it is because it's already been established that half the people who voted for Xabi Alonso actually meant to vote for Xabi, which would have potentially affected who finished second in this race. And I think it's also ridiculous that one-third of the voters, their ballots were either lost or apparently they didn't bother voting. It's still unclear. And among them includes countries like Norway, like the Republic of Ireland, like your friends in Qatar, Paddy, like the United Arab Emirates, South Africa, you know, places that you would think would know how to go and vote in an election like this. And if FIFA can't organize this seriously, it does undermine their credibility. Thanks for joining us. You can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find all your news, your gossip, your analysis, George Culkin's excellent blog on Tuesdays. Also, our web chats. I do mine on Mondays. Ollie's is on Wednesdays. And remember, you can always follow us on Twitter as well. I'm on there, Ollie's on there, Patty's on there, Tony Barrett now, the latest addition to the Times writers on Twitter. Till next time, ta-ta.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.